I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
Car standby, car standby. Assist the officer, third call, 3750 North 50. We got an officer down. That's repeating in the 13th District, 3750 North 50. Assist the officer, police fire radio, third call. We got an officer shot at that location.
That's a police dispatcher yesterday afternoon alerting Philadelphia police officers that there was a shootout in the Nicetown Tioga section of the city. More than 7 hours later, the alleged shooter, Maurice Hill, surrendered to police after wounding six officers, although none of those injuries were life-threatening. The shooting started when Hill was reportedly served a narcotics warrant. For a time, two police officers were trapped on the second floor of the house with three people they had arrested while the alleged shooter fired into the ceiling. Now, there are two daycare centers across the street from this house that were in lockdown before the children were taken to safety. The residents in this neighborhood reported hearing hundreds of gunshots through the night. We asked Max Maron to join us. He's a reporter for WHYY's Billy Penn. He was there last night, part of a team of WHYY reporters and producers covering this incident. And Max, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So let's start at the beginning. This was, what, about 4:30 in the afternoon yesterday?
4:30 in the afternoon yesterday. We're sitting in the office here watching some of the chopper footage of what's going on, and it's immediately apparent that this isn't a normal unfortunately run-of-the-mill shooting that we see in Philadelphia. Multiple injuries, chaos on the scene. So by the time we get up there, what is about to be a seven-hour standoff begins, near a very busy section of North Philadelphia. You have to keep in mind this is a transit hub. It's one block from Broad and Erie in Germantown. This convergence, it's a few blocks from Temple's medical campus, and there's a lot of activity and a lot of businesses, a lot of family and community to live here. And so it's just all these moving parts happening, and it's happening very quickly. And there's reports of gunfire coming from this house where these officers are holed up. And at the same time, they're trying to just mediate a lot of different things happening at once.
Sure. We heard that dispatcher sending officers there. How many officers would you say were there, and what kind of tactical equipment did they have?
Well, it was a group of officers, the initial group of officers that entered the building to serve the search warrant. Again, we're still gathering the details. We're not even sure if the suspect who's been arrested, the alleged gunman, what is the person that they were seeking for the search warrant. There were other people arrested in the house that these officers were barricaded into bedrooms upstairs for several hours during the standoff. And the gunman is downstairs and reportedly on the police scanner, and the police confirmed that he was firing upstairs at officers in the rooms where they've detained some other what they're calling prisoners. And then he's simultaneously firing outside at the police on the street.
And the prisoners were the people that the police on the second floor had arrested. They were handcuffed,
right,
correct?
Right, the second or third floor, one of the upper floors, they had handcuffed some and done this. So, yes, as part of the police's tactics for initiating these search warrants, they go in with an area of responsibility. They target these rooms, they arrest people, they hold them down, and then clearly gunfire had broken out as soon as they got in this building, which is awesome, often happens.
What do we know about Maurice Hill, the alleged shooter?
36 years old, extensive criminal history, according to Commissioner Richard Ross. The gunman, in his own words, communicated with police about his past and his history and kind of in the negotiating that was happening over the period of several hours. His attorney, Shaka Johnson, was called. Maurice apparently called his attorney from the house. And Shaka Johnson told reporters last night at the scene that he was actually just watching on TV when he had no idea who was inside when he got the call from his former client, who he had represented in criminal cases before. One of Hill had been arrested a dozen times since he was 18. And the attorney came to the scene, and it's highly unusual for police to negotiate with a defense attorney and the district attorney at the scene. But obviously, this is a very highly unusual situation. So we have, that component of it, and that's around, somewhere between around 10 o'clock this is happening.
10 o'clock last night, yep.
10 o'clock at night, and at this point, the SWAT team is able to get the officers from inside the building out of the house.
How did they do that?
I'm not exactly privy to the details, but they were able to do it safely without injury. The gunshots, the last report we heard of gunshots is around 8 o'clock. And at this point, at midnight when Hill eventually surrendered, but in the meantime, there's a lot of other things going on impacting the community around, the neighbors. And there's a daycare I'm sure you heard about where children had to be relocated,
Something like 50 kids,
right? Yeah, 50 kids. I talked to some of the mothers of the parents that were there trying to find their kids, and they got the panicked call in the afternoon that
frightening.
Can't imagine, right? So,
do we know what kind of weapon Maurice Hill was using?
The only mentions that we heard were of a long gun. It was clearly high capacity. There was clearly a lot of ammo involved. I mean, the reports were of hundreds of gunshots. And, you know, police definitely were sustaining fire. And then if you, you know, for anyone who watched the, you know, the aerial footage on the news, I mean, this is clearly just a lot of bullets flying around. I mean, you could see brick dust breaking off of the buildings, and you could see officers bleeding, rushing into squad cars to be taken off to Temple Hospital.
Lots of wounded police officers, six of them, but thank goodness no one was fatally fatally injured. Were they all released from the hospital? Do we know?
They were all released from the hospital last night. That's correct. Non-life-threatening injuries.
Lucky, right?
Indeed.
Let me play a clip from your reporting, Max. This is Tiffany Burra. She's the mother of a three-year-old who attends one of those daycare centers called Precious Babies.
Right.
And this is right across the street from where this shootout and standoff took place. And let's give it a listen.
My aunt called me like around 4:45. Like I was asleep, woke me up and told me that this my son daycare on the news. So I just started crying and called the daycare. They said they were safe. They got the kids in the stairwell. And that they'll keep me updated on anything that's going on.
I mean, just imagine being a parent and with a child in a daycare center across the street from what is happening there. Talking with other people in the neighborhood, I assume they were kept at bay.
Correct, yeah. We have a very tight, whatever your perceptions are of this neighborhood, there's a lot of tight-knit community, a lot of neighbors who just know everybody and what's going on. And, you know, a lot of just, you know, family families who were living on these blocks. And so this is when the police cordon off this area where the shooting is unhappening, the shootout is unfolding around 4 in the afternoon. There's, you know, several dozens, if not over 100 people that we saw who were just waiting to get back into their houses within the cordoned off area. The police tried to evacuate as many as they could. Some people stayed in their houses that I heard about. But there's a lot of people who just can't get home. And basically they're waiting until after midnight and well after until the police area deem the area secure to get back into their homes. But what you have on the other end is, you know, daycare and other businesses in the vicinity. And in this case of the daycare, you're having 50-some children evacuated in the middle of the day and placed in a safe location, which is several blocks away. So I located a area where they had the children waiting in off-duty SEPTA buses and just checking and waiting and connecting with all the parents and making sure they arrive. And, you know, you can imagine the distress of the parents arriving and trying to just get the children out of the situation. So, I mean, there's a sense of, you know, real urgency and just families struggling to just sort of contend with this
now,
very dynamic situation.
Absolutely. Now, Maurice Hill surrendered a little bit after midnight. Can you describe what happened, Max?
There was a significant lull in the night as reporters are gathered at on 15th Street, about 500 feet from the site of the house. We can see tactical vehicles and various law enforcement agencies all coordinating and trying out sort of different tactics. At one point, they tow a car. They move. They're moving some equipment. And, you know, there's a big lull happening. It's been raining on and off all night. We're all staring and just seeing what is going to go down. There's no, you know, never know if a gunfire is going to pop off. At some point, there is loud noise and everybody jumps. But at midnight sharp, we hear the sounds of tear gas being fired into the vicinity of the house where the shooter is holed up. And we hear them getting on the megaphone and, you know, saying, down on your hands and knees, down on your hands. And he was quickly, within seconds, very anticlimactic. It was placed in a police car and then just sort of hush fell through the neighborhood.
And whisked away, obviously.
Yes.
Did you see him at all?
We couldn't make out any. We were a little too far away to make out exactly any details about that. But there was,
And then quiet, right?
Yeah. I mean, eerily quiet, I would say. I mean, there was this... Everybody just sort of stopped talking for a couple minutes after it happened. I mean, it's kind of the end of the seven-hour ordeal.
Let me play Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross speaking to the press last night after this resolution.
I have to admit, I did not think that this guy was going to come out alive. After several conversations with him and hearing a bunch of information throughout the afternoon, he was indicating that he was not going back to prison. So he was not coming out live. It took several hours to make any reasonable contact with him. Much of that ended with a bunch of unreasonable requests on his part that, quite frankly, could not be accommodated. So we exhausted every measure that we could. As the night went on, we did have more lengthy conversations with him, some of which ended with his attorney. So it was an unusual circumstance, so we took unusual steps.
That was Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross speaking last night. And Max, I mean, just in hindsight, you've got one man in a house with some kind of a weapon holding off the Philadelphia police force.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty dramatic to watch in an era where we're seeing what people call mass shootings play out week after week. Situations of, you know, one person with one gun versus, you know, an entire crowd, whether they're armed or not. I mean, here we have the entire Philadelphia police force seemingly on this one block of North Philadelphia and are unable to, contain the situation immediately. And it's really a difficult testament. But, you know, per what Ross said, this is these are very dynamic situations for police officers.
Right. Very fluid. And also, we don't have time to go into it deeply, Max, but serving a warrant, you and I were doing some research this morning, serving a warrant is a potentially dangerous thing for a police officer to do.
Right, yes. And the overwhelming number of arrest warrants that are issued in Philadelphia and nationwide are for these narcotics cases. So you have similar situations like this where you're identifying a suspect and law enforcement tries to determine like a risk factor for that person. You know, what is their flight risk? What is their violence risk? And then they're assessing that before they go and try to, you know, make the arrest. And, we don't have the details for the Philadelphia situation about whether this was what they call a no-knock warrant, where they just sort of burst in and try to contain the situation right away, or whether this was like a knock warrant that just turned into the officers in the house and making this happen. But it's nationwide. There's a lot of criticism about these sorts of warrants for putting officers and the communities nearby, and also other civilians who may be in the house and unrelated to the alleged criminal activity at risk.
We're almost out of time here. What will you be, once you get a couple of hours of sleep, what will you be doing next, Max, as you begin to investigate what happened in Philadelphia last night?
I think we're trying to just piece together the impact that something like this has on the community, or why, in a city that sees as many shootings as we do, why we see such a response for something of this grandeur, and, you know, how we kind of relay that into solutions and hear the voices of our community when this is happening, unfortunately, a lot.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Well, Max Maron, thanks so much for joining us
today,
Marty, on Radio and Times. And he's a reporter for WHYY's Billy Penn. He was at the incident last night. In fact, part of a team of WHYY reporters and producers covering this incident, this shootout and standoff that happened in North Philadelphia in the Nicetown Tioga section of the city. Six police officers were wounded. Thank goodness none of those injuries were life-threatening. We're going to shift gears after this very short break. We'll be talking about how to pay attention in a world of distractions, how to do nothing. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moskowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Who doesn't feel inundated, even assaulted, by data coming at us from every which way, all that social media on all of our devices calling for us, to respond and respond now. And don't forget the demands of the analog world between work and home and dropping off the kids at daycare or school or soccer or checking in on mom and dad at the nursing home. It's easy to feel stressed and burned out, like you're working all the time and getting nothing done because something is always vying for your attention. It's a common lament these days. That's why we booked Jenny Odell and Rob Walker to be our guests. They have a lot to say and a lot to suggest about how to find enjoyment and calm in today's harried world. Rob Walker is an advice columnist for Life Hacker, and he's on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts, wrote a book called The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. And Rob Walker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us also is Jenny Odell. She's a multimedia artist, a writer, and she's the author of a book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And Jenny Odell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me start with you, Rob, but Jenny, I'd like to hear from you as well. And it's funny, when you look back 100 years or even more, you find this common lament that there's everything is vying for our attention. We're just distracted all the time. Is there something unique about the time that we're living in now?
Yeah, I mean, it's true, you can find those complaints going back quite a ways, and perhaps 100 years from now, it will still be going on, and there will be new things for us to complain about. But I think that there's no question that year over year, the ways we can be distracted and the number of sort of entities seeking our are able to distract us keep metastasizing. And of course, the big culprit that we all look at immediately is our phones.
Sure. Beckoning to us all day long.
Yeah.
So, Jenny, how much should we just blame technology, or is it more complicated than that?
I think that it is probably more complicated, but what is genuinely new, I would say, is maybe the extent to which, or maybe the extent of the technology and how granular it is. Like, you know, when I use the phrase attention economy in the subtitle of my book, the attention economy, it's really, you know, that could just be the history of advertising. Like anything where, you know, people have studied how to catch and hold other people's attention. But, you know, what we have now is like, you know, an extremely detailed and granular version of that, where it's no longer even restricted to advertising. It's like every, you know, aspect of how you communicate with other people or express parts of your life is filled with notifications and almost like a gamified character. So I would say it just feels almost more embedded in daily life than it did before.
The idea that someone is buying or selling our attention. I think that's what you write in your book, Jenny.
Right. And again, I mean, you could say that is, you know, not unique to social media, but that social media has maybe found like a uniquely effective way of doing that.
You know, Rob, I was thinking of my phone, which calls to me all day long. And I was also thinking about the psychology classes I took in college about intermittent reinforcement. And the hardest behavior for a rat to change was when they were intermittently reinforced. Sometimes it was good news. Sometimes it was bad news. Sometimes it was a pellet. Sometimes it was a shock. But that was the hardest behavior to undo. And I'm wondering whether we're kind of rats in a maze these days.
You're going with the upbeat approach.
we'll get to the upbeat, but yes.
No, yeah. No, I'm sure that there's some truth to that. And obviously, you know, part of what Jenny is talking about is relevant here, that you could not only get notifications from the news or from advertisers, but, you know, literally friends and acquaintances and people you work with. And then there's this, yeah, this pressure to feel like, well, I bet, you know, they call it the so-called fear of missing out. Which is not a totally irrational thing.
No.
There are good reasons why you want to be aware of what your peers and tribe are up to. But unfortunately, you know, you don't need to be aware of them all the time. And one of the problems to me that I focus on a lot, or that I find the most disturbing about the way that this, you know, as attention economy works now, and I found this with students, is that they would feel that if they were noticing something and everybody else wasn't talking about it, it wasn't trending, that it must not be important. And I think that's a really catastrophic conclusion, not just for designers, which the students I teach are design students, but for anybody. Because really noticing the things that other people aren't paying attention to yet, that other people have overlooked, is kind of an important part of being a person.
Well, in fact, that's part of the message of your book, The Art of Noticing, seeing things that other people don't see.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that came kind of out of the class that I teach, and it's something I believe in pretty strongly. And yeah, it's a theme that runs through the book. And I was interested in, I was a little frustrated at the time. I started doing the book because I was a little frustrated with most of the advice that I was hearing about this subject. And this is obviously before Jenny's book had come out. But if her book had come out, maybe I wouldn't have bothered to write mine. But
I was
mostly seeing advice that had to do with denial, with like what to quit and what to throw away and how to take us about. And I wasn't seeing a lot of advice about what to do that would be appealing or informative or helpful or just fun.
Well, in fact, that's the reason we wanted both of you on, because both of you, including you, Jenny, you're saying while this technology is trying to grab our attention all the time, the solution is not to toss our devices into the local river or down the toilet. We have to figure out how to live with all this stuff, right?
Right. Well, not only that, I think that if, you know, if you make it about trying to quit using your phone, you're still thinking about it. Like, you're still existing on the same plane. Like, it's the sort of classic, like, quitting Facebook and posting about it on Twitter.
Right.
You haven't actually exited the problem. I, as an artist, like, you know, a lot of my work is driven by and tries to produce curiosity. And I've always found curiosity a really powerful tool. It's almost like the flip side of fear. Like, both fear and curiosity are attitudes toward the unknown. And curiosity really can, I mean, even morbid curiosity. Like, I like to get morbidly curious about advertising. Like, sometimes I will look at my own ads as if they were written by, you know, a sci-fi author 20 years ago writing about a dystopian future. But, you know, I think that directing curiosity towards anything, including oneself and one's own habits, already introduces a kind of separation between the self and those habits, a kind of interruption that can allow you to look at what you're doing. Like, even sometimes when I've been on my phone for a while, I just think about what my face looks like. You know, like, what has my face looked like for the last 5 minutes? It's often frowning. We're looking at other people's faces when they look at their phones. So I think that there's just a lot that curiosity can do there beyond just kind of like punishing oneself for how much you use your phone.
Right. I mean, that's not particularly helpful. Let me go back to you, Rob Walker. And one of your book is full of things to do, things to think about doing. I tried one this morning as I was walking to work, and you said, look up. You know, look up. And I saw, oh my goodness, I saw the tops of some beautiful buildings on Market Street in Philadelphia that are probably 100 years old with these lovely little architectural details. But I also got the feeling, and I think both of you really say this, is think how you or act the way you are when you're a tourist and you're in a new place and you don't know where anything is.
Yeah. Or like a child.
Or like a child.
Is another way of thinking about it. And yeah, so the my publisher doesn't like it when I call them assignments. But so there's 131 prompts or provocations or whatever. And some of them are just that simple. And it's by intent, is to have things like just add looking up to your day, or just, you know, tomorrow look for the color red everywhere you go, or look out a window that you always ignore. To be sort of, these are meant to be like little gateway things that are fun. Some of them are more involved. But the point is that instead of reaching for your phone to see which YouTube stars are feuding on Twitter today, you know, give yourself a little reward and give yourself a break. Even a small one can make a big difference. And yeah, think about how often you walked past these things, the architectural details you're talking about, and never noticed them, and now you've added a little something to your day.
I sure did. That's Rob Walker. He's an advice columnist for Life Hacker, author of a book called The Art of Noticing. Jenny O'Dell is with us as well. She's a multimedia artist, a writer, and she's the author of a book called How to Do Nothing. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jenny, what is nothing? When you say the art of doing nothing, what does that entail besides nothing?
It can, you know, it can really be anything as long as it's not goal-oriented. That's how I usually define it. So maybe a good example is walking somewhere versus going for a walk. So if you're walking somewhere, you're probably trying to take the most efficient or the fastest route, and you've achieved your goal when you've gotten to the destination. Whereas going for a walk, if you really wanted to go for a long walk and you were just ending up back at your house, you would probably choose the most inefficient route, or an inefficient route anyway. And you would, you know, for me, when I go for a walk, it's just for the purposes of looking around. So I've already achieved my goal once I'm walking. So pretty much, you know, all of the things that I describe, at least myself doing in the book, fall into that category. Mm-hmm. Like bird watching is another example where the goal is to see birds, but there's not, you know, it's just sort of a state of openness in which you may see something or you may not. And just to add to that point about looking up or architectural details even, I recently went on a historical walking tour of the neighborhood, the sort of waterfront in Oakland where my studio is. And I consider myself very familiar with that area, and I do go for walks there. And I was so almost embarrassed and humbled by how little I knew about that neighborhood.
Wow. Yeah.
in particular, that it's an industrial neighborhood. And so the tour guide pointed out that the roofs there are kind of domed almost in a way, like to create more space inside the warehouse. And she was like, you know, when you take BART to the city, just look towards the water and you'll see like these hills and mountains of these roofs. And sure enough, you know, I took BART yesterday, which is normally, you know, I look out and I see like the normal things I look at, like the port and the water. And I just could not believe that I had not noticed this very obvious aspect of the landscape. Like, I don't know what I thought the roofs looked like, but I clearly just wasn't looking at them. And so I really love having that kind of experience. And that is definitely something I would also classify as you know, quote unquote, not doing nothing, but you're not doing something, you're noticing something.
Well, it's so interesting, Rob, to be so familiar with a place, but not have seen certain things about it.
Yeah, and I've had a couple of experiences like this. I think I can't remember if I left it in the book or not, but there was the suggestion of be a tourist in your home, to, like literally try to be a tourist in your hometown. And we used to live in Savannah, and it's a very – I thought I knew it pretty well, but I had a cousin visiting, and we actually took like the kind of the corny bus tour that you would never take. And it was such a blast, and we learned so much about the – hometown.
About your own hometown, right.
But also, I'll put in a word for kind of less traditional. One of the things that got me started on this whole process was a trip to San Francisco, which is a city I have visited a number of times. So I'm sort of familiar with the architecture and no longer in that kind of jaw-drop mode. And I was going to be really busy, and I wanted to give myself some kind of assignment, looking assignment. And I just, my one parameter was that I wanted to look for something that no one particularly wanted me to look for. So it was, I chose security cameras, and just like everywhere I went, I would look for security cameras. And it really, this kind of thing really shifts your view of, first of all, how pervasive they are, but it has you looking at a streetscape in a different way. It has all these, and I had no real point to this, to sort of go with what Jenny was saying earlier about doing nothing. I'm a big fan of, like, you don't have to be productive all the time. Yeah. I think people are too obsessed with and that's where social media comes in, because it feels productive somehow. Like, well, at least I'm getting through my Instagram feed. That's not really producing anything. And sometimes it's nice to give yourself a break and shift perspective and find out what you're missing and how it might, you know, pay off for you in other ways.
Oh, that's interesting, because, Jenny, you also look at productivity kind of trying to reframe it, I think, for us.
Yeah, I ask the question in my book, you know, when we say the word productivity even, and I should add that I'm basically from Silicon Valley, so I've been very...
you know, productivity,
Yeah, I'm steeped in productivity culture, and at a certain point, I kind of ask, like, productive of what, why, and for whom? And once you kind of start to ask these questions, our version of productivity, at least the traditional version, starts to look very narrow. For example, like you could have a lot of companies very productively, you know, being very productive financially that are maybe destroying the planet. Or, you know, an industrial farm that is very productive of products, of food, but it's depleting the soil. And so, you know, from a certain other perspective, it's very unproductive. And so I am questioning that the assumptions around our normal idea of productivity and kind of trying to propose a different idea of productive, which is a productivity that is cognizant of the roles of caring and maintenance and, you know, regeneration and sustaining systems that might from a certain perspective look backward or more like restoration, but that from the perspective of collective well-being would look like productivity.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And another way even to think about our economy. Rob, let me go back to you and get to a couple of more assignments, as you call them. And Jenny was talking about just taking a walk with no particular purpose. I think about, you know, GPS, we use them. I have to say, when I'm in a strange place, I'm always happy to have it because then I know I won't get lost. But I hear... or I read in your book about just that there's nothing wrong with getting lost from time to time. In fact, maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it can be. And I to talk about it as at least try to get there the hard way sometimes. I'm not the first person to talk about this, that the way that we rely on GPS kind of messes with our ability to understand space that we're moving through and how it relates to other spaces that we've been in. And there are all these terrible stories of people following their GPS instructions and driving like directly into the lake or
because
the
they're looking at their phone, kind
terrible
of thing.
Thing. They're just so convinced that whatever it's telling them must be the right thing to do. And especially when I'm in a new place, I do always try to make it a point to take at least one. If not completely phoneless, then one phone minimal walk. You know, I don't actually want to get completely lost in a strange place. But, you know, to give yourself that time. And it's to go to the point about productivity and how to define it, you know, it's about discovery and curiosity and leading yourself to conclusions or to epiphanies that you wouldn't have if you were doing everything the most efficient way. Right. It's almost a determined inefficiency that I think you can look for sometimes.
Let me read a couple of comments. I'll reintroduce you and we'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Bill says, a lesson on being deliberate that I learned from a tracker was to keep my eyes wide open and to look for things that I did not normally look for, really underscoring, Rob, what you were saying. An email from Ronald, as a retired teacher, recent technology, especially since the introduction of the smartphone, has been a game changer. Grades in my class dropped, fewer A's and B's, more C's and D's. Students are less intelligent. They're less focused and more easily distracted. I know that's a common lament in many schools. We're talking with Jenny Odell. She's a multimedia artist. She's a writer, and she's the author of a new book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Rob Walker is with us as well. He's an advice columnist for Life Hacker. He's on the faculty at the School of Visual Arts, and he's got a book, too, called The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Send us more emails, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Rob Walker and Jenny Odell. Jenny, you mentioned bird watching, and that seems an important part of I guess, a discovery that and a way of paying attention that seems very central to your book.
It is, and I'm now realizing it also fulfills the assignment of looking up because you're often having to look up into trees. But yeah, it's really it's speaking of that kind of humbling factor that I was mentioning earlier. I have been humbled in the last couple of years, just in terms of realizing, you know, that I wasn't noticing bird sound at all. And then I was noticing it. Then I can make out maybe three or four, then maybe five or six different birds. And then at this point it's, you know, same bird, different times of the year. And I think this process could just kind of go on and on. Like your attention could become more and more specific, where there could be more points, within your attention, almost like higher resolution or something. And I really enjoy the state that it sort of requires, which is that it's, you know, of course the term is bird watching, but as I say in the book, it's really, it should be called bird noticing, because so often you hear something first and then you look for it. You also have to look at things like, you know, what kind of tree is it in? How is it moving around? What time of year is it? It sort of requires you to be extremely aware of everything around you as contextual information. And it's interesting because it's, you know, the phrase doing nothing, it's, for some people it sounds lazy, but although I find bird watching to be very calming, it does require a state of alertness that I would not describe as passive or lazy, that it's actually, but I also wouldn't describe it as work. So it's kind of something in between where I am not producing anything or feeling obligated to produce anything, but I'm also very present and very aware of everything that's around me and not kind of lagging on that.
I mean, it seems very almost meditative or, you know, that's the mindfulness, you know, part of paying attention.
Yeah, I think it shares a lot in common with more maybe traditional mindfulness practices. And it's just that I sort of came to it almost in a roundabout way. Even the way that I started bird watching, it wasn't like one day I set out to become a bird watcher. It was just that I happen to live in a neighborhood where you almost can't not you. Hmm. You have to notice them. They're everywhere. And at a certain point, I just became curious. Like, okay, what's that weird little green bird? And then that was like, you know, my gateway bird.
And what was that little green bird?
So it's not actually green. I realized that it's greenish. It just is because of the time of day that I saw it. It was a cedar waxwing. And they're here in the winter, especially, or the almost, you know, all year except for the summer. And again, this I find this experience to be both pleasant and sometimes embarrassing, which is like I saw one, I figured out what it was, I got really excited, and then I saw a few more, and I actually pulled this lady over who was walking down the street, and I was like, look at those, are cedar waxwings, they're so amazing. And they are really amazing, but they're also pretty common here. And she was like, yeah, cedar waxwings, you know. And then I like slowly realized that I had actually been seeing them everywhere every year, and I'd heard that sound everywhere.
Oh, that's, but now you can recognize it. It's so interesting. Rob, let me go back to you, and one of your assignments in this book is take a photo walk with no camera. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, it was inspired by reading one of these sort of, you know, sets of tips on the internet about how to take better pictures, and it made me think these are all really interesting ideas, but maybe if you did them without the camera, it would be even more interesting. You were just forced to, you know, look at a situation and think about the shadows, kind of find the framing in it that you want, and then just tell yourself, like, okay, that's a mm-hmm. picture, and move on to the next thing. And we spend so much time documenting the world that we don't really appreciate it. We just sort of want to record it. But can I pick up on the birdsong thing for a second?
Of course,
because one of the way the book is organized, it actually does start out with all visual stuff, because I think that's our first instinct, is to think of noticing and to think of the visual. But it does then move explicitly into other senses. So it's a really valuable point to talk about. You know, birdsong is a great gateway thing to get people to awaken their other senses. And some of the assignments in the book get a little more involved. One of them is to make a neighborhood sound map. Yeah. But even if you don't do that, if you give yourself that general prompt, at least for me, that has had the effect of thinking a lot about, like, sort of listening at my neighborhood in a different way. And that does involve birdsong, but also, you know, I live fairly close to a train track, and there's a drawbridge that you can hear sometimes. And then also, you know, my neighbor Peter likes to talk on his front porch to whoever's walking by. And it becomes interesting to think of your neighborhood just in terms of sound. And it's just a different way of engaging with the world.
Well, I'm a radio person. I'm a sound person, obviously.
Sure.
But I'm thinking also what you said about, you know, looking without a camera. And I, you know, I am embarrassed to say that sometimes I've been on a trip where I so quickly whip out my camera to capture a scene that, of course, I look at when I get home, but kind of realizing, gosh, maybe I really missed actually looking at it.
Yeah, and I read somewhere that at least you're looking at the picture when you get home. It's not every picture that's taken gets even looked at this point, which mm-hmm. is kind of a sad comment. And and there are spaces that are now built, I guess, to make them more Instagrammable. And
yeah.
You know, I'm not against taking pictures. I'm not against photography. I'm not against documenting your life. But again, I feel like maybe if you deny yourself that every once in a while, it might trick up the way that you're engaging with the world around you.
Let me read a comment from Maria, and then we'll get some callers in. Maria says, I had an eye-opening experience on a vacation to Europe a few years ago. I took hundreds of photos, but my kids' photos were from such a different perspective and captured very different things, like the shape of the toilet in our hotel room. It was great to compare our perspectives. Rob is someone who teaches at the School of Visual Arts. What do you say?
Kids can be brilliant,
yeah.
You know, and that they haven't seen it all. They don't know. They haven't, you know, taken in the set of mores and quote unquote rules about what counts as interesting and what doesn't. They're very interested in the world. And it can be a great thing to try to look at the world with that childlike perspective, especially if you have access to an actual child, to pay attention to how they're paying attention to the world. And I hope I'll be forgiven for this leap. I don't have kids, but I kind of try to do this with my dog because I walk my dog every day.
Sure.
And, you know, we're walking the same basic territory. And it helps keep me engaged if I can just try to pay attention to what he's paying attention to and, you know, what he's wanting to smell and trying to figure out why he's trying to do it. I mean, usually the answer is he's trying to eat something. But
well, I was going to say he's not looking up. He's probably looking down, right?
No, he's not looking up. He looks up with his nose.
Yeah, exactly. Let me get Matthew from Elverson, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. And Matthew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. One of the things I'm really concerned about these days is the concept of siloing, where people get through the internet and social media trapped in a circle of things that only reinforce what they want to see or hear. And I wonder how the guests think of this distractibility as it relates to this concept of siloing.
That's a really interesting question, Matthew. I'm going to see what Jenny Odell has to say. Jenny, as an artist, what do you think?
So I actually have a little section of my book specifically about this, where I describe being, I think I use the word entombed in your algorithmic recommendations. So as a thought experiment, I imagine that I only listen to Spotify and I like, you know, I listen to my Discover Weekly, right? And I like all the songs that I like, and it would just become more and more sort of an archetypal mix of things that I like within that context. And I contrast that with the fact that I listen to the radio in the car because I don't have an aux input in my car. And I listen to community radio stations, one of which I found out recently the DJs are actually required to play like three or four different genres of music in one show. And I will often, you know, I don't like everything that I hear, but I will often hear something that I not only like, I like in ways and for reasons that I don't understand, which for me in that moment reminds me that I am actually something more than, you know, a personal brand that has very stable likes and dislikes. I'm actually a sort of like shifting entity that is open to influences, and that there are, you know, there are parts of me that are, you know, I have not yet discovered or mm-hmm. have not yet been formed because I haven't encountered these unexpected things. And so that's why I put so much emphasis in the book on public spaces where you could conceivably talk to other people. I have an ode to the bus system in the East Bay. I'm a big fan of the bus. But I think, you know, these are just important counterbalances to, yeah, this idea that you could very easily, even when you're not, you know, expressly on your phone, that you could live your whole life only paying attention to things insofar as they matter to you in a very narrow sense, or that they could be used by you. There's a writer named Byung Chul Han whose book I just read, it's called The Agony of Eros, and he uses this phrase, the inferno of the same, to describe the situation, the inferno of the same is that in which you only ever really encounter yourself reflected back at yourself, and you never are surprised or encounter something truly outside of yourself.
Oh, I love that, the inferno of the same. Anything you want to add to that, Rob?
No, that was pretty good. I think, you know, it's a variation on that efficiency theme from earlier. And it's a little bit sad the way that the algorithm shapes our consumption so much of the time now. And what it does is level out or make much less likely the, you know, luck, chance, serendipity that, if you think about it, probably is a highlight of many cultural experiences that you've had, or you know, that's what discovering something is really about, is having it come to you in an unexpected way and not knowing that you were going to like it. There's no, like, it's hard to imagine the algorithm that would deliver birdsong into your life.
Sure. You know. Matthew, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Chris from Frankfurt has to say. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi there, Chris.
Oh,
go
hi.
Ahead.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Your discussion just reminded me of something that happened when I was very young. I was working at a restaurant in South Philly, and I was only there for a few weeks when I had to go on a trip to go pick up some provisions, I think, for the bar, along with a guy who had been doing this for years. And I had never been in a neighborhood before, and you know, to exemplify what you're talking about almost hilariously, I noticed that a few blocks from the place where we were picking up the provisions, someone had built the front of an airplane, an actual airplane, into their home. At least I think it was a home. But there was a fuselage, the front nose and pilot's cabin of an airplane.
Wow.
Which the guy I was going with had never noticed before. So I thought, well, that kind of gets to what you're talking about. Yeah, this really happened. So
yeah, that's great, Chris. Yeah, lucky.
Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Okay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, Jenny, sounds like sort of like some of your experiences out there in Oakland.
Yeah, and I think you can have this experience within yourself where, you know, like new you is embarrassed at old you. Or, you know, this is one of the things that happens, I think, when people have friends come visit them, maybe for the first time from another city, where, you know, you just have a different pair of eyes looking at things. I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about with children. And I have to confess that part of this time I've been watching some crows outside my window. Because if you've read the book, you know that I have some, I wouldn't call them pet crows, but crows recognize human faces and remember them. And so I basically have known these crows for about 3 years, and I see them, they come here at this time every morning and for a peanut. But I was looking at one of them and thinking about, you know, whenever I look at them, I think about what they see. Like, I think about their perspective on my apartment building, which otherwise looks very boring. And paying attention to them has helped me notice the shape of the hill that I live on, which is pretty steep, but it's not really a straightforward kind of lump, right? It has a shape, and I can see them negotiating, you know, like, where are all the really tall redwood trees, or what are the good roofs to land on? And so just spending time looking at them has kind of had that effect on me on just like my own street.
We are almost out of time. And Rob, just one little section in your book having to do with others. We've been talking about all these devices that, you know, that demand our attention, but the importance of focusing on the people in our lives.
Yeah, well, actually, this all ties together the last couple of points, because, you know, one of the things that you can learn by or one of the ways that you can sort of reframe how you see the world is to try to see it through someone else's point of view. And that can be true in terms of what you read online. And it can be true in terms of, one of the suggestions in the book is to take a walk with an expert on another subject, which can be a really eye-opening experience. Talk with someone who really knows a lot about plants if you don't know a lot about plants, and they're going to see your neighborhood in a completely different way than you do.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Rob Walker, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's an advice columnist for Life Hacker on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts, the author of a book called The Art of Noticing. Jenny O'Dell, thank you very much for joining us as well.
It's my pleasure.
And she's a multimedia artist. She's a writer, and she's the author of a book called How to Do Nothing. And we appreciate all those calls and comments to Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Help today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Here's some Otis Redding.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in. I watch them roll away again. I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. 'Cause I've got nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide.